Today is Monday, March 26th. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website at citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing.
Good evening. It is 5:06 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
As well, we'll be speaking to Atiya Jaffer from the Pakistani Students Association and also to AMS President Matt Parson and Associate VP Academic Sean Craigton, my apologies, about the recent ruling on Gage South.
Follow this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus news and your local headlines.
So, first of all, we're going to be talking to Atiya. So, as I mentioned, over the weekend, the Pakistani Students Association put together their first conference titled Destination South Asia. So we're joined now by Atiya, who's the vice president of the PSA. Just to find out more about how that went. So, Atiya, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Claire. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you? Are you relaxing after the big weekend?
Yeah, it was a really big weekend. But, I mean, you were there, so tell me what you thought of Destination South Asia.
Well, I think for me, it was a lot of fun. It was very interesting because I think a lot of times you see those conferences that are put on by specific clubs and they have very sort of targeted interests. And I found that with your conference, that wasn't really the case. I think there was a very diverse range of topics that were covered. And because of that, a very diverse audience who was there. And I think people from all different faculties, all different backgrounds and with different interests who all were able to get something out of it. So I guess tell us a bit about, I guess, the roots of the conference and where it came from and why you started it.
Yeah, definitely. So the conference, which was entitled Destination South Asia, it kind of stemmed from an idea that I had in September, I guess, last year. I'm in the Global Resource Systems Program in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, and one of the things that we do is we declare a regional specialization. So mine is South Asia, and I realized that there aren't too many courses at UBC that are offered on the subject. So I thought, you know, why not kind of explore what is there, what is present, the research that people are doing in the area, and kind of give people a place to talk about it. And we had no idea what it would look like, but luckily, since I was part of the Pakistan Students Association, we put our heads together and we decided to host a conference. And we had no idea how to do it, so we just pretty much contacted as many people as possible, any professor at UBC or SFU who had any sort of research that was relating to the region, and we kind of compiled it into a conference. So our response was quite diverse, and that's, like you said, it was a diverse conference, and that was because the professors interested had a range of topics that they were researching. So in the end, we developed four streams. So environment and development was one. So we had profs talking about climate change and how urbanization influences environmental change, and also about the Indus River and how that's managed. And we had arts and culture. We had politics and economy. And we had health. So those are our four streams, and that way we were able to engage a lot of people. I mean, not only was the conference kind of intended to extend to all of the region, not just Pakistan or not just India. It was also trying to aim to include a lot of different disciplines as well. And we were really humbled by the response. We had 80 delegates on Saturday, and it was a really sunny day, so I was very surprised that people wanted to sit inside and talk about issues relating to the region. But it was quite nice. And we were also funded by the Global Fund and by the Center for India and South Asia Research, which also really helped us a lot. And it made the conference free for everyone who was attending.
Yeah, well, I think that's something we definitely appreciated, just going to that and attending and having sort of that quality of lectures and being able to see it free of charge. And I think that's really what it comes down to, what the university is about, and having that sort of education available to whoever is interested in it. I guess looking forward, do you hope to do this again next year? Do you see it expanding? Like, what's in the works for you guys?
Yeah, definitely. I think the only thing that I would say about the conference that was kind of not too much of a positive note was that the topics that we discussed were kind of, or at least the sessions that I went to, were kind of a little bit sad and a little bit kind of, at the end, you felt like the world was doomed a little bit. So I think a lot of people were interested in continuing the conversation, and kind of the theme for this year's conference was kind of getting the conversation started. So moving forward, I think, you know, it's important to kind of look at the issues in more depth and look at solutions at a certain point as well. So one thing that we were thinking was to keep the conversation going through a website or a blog. So to have people kind of add on, or, you know, look into things and then kind of pose their questions, and maybe have the profs post their slides, the ones that presented at the conference. And then we do hope to have another conference again next year as well.
Well, yeah, like, congratulations once again. It was great, and it was really great to be out there and see all the people who are out there. So. Yeah, I guess, is there anything else you'd like to add about the conference? Or
Yeah, I just wanted to thank all the students that were involved in helping us plan it. It was a team effort, and I think everyone did such an amazing job. We had people helping us, you know, print name tags out at 2 in the morning the night before. We had people kind of, you know, contacting profs and making sure that they would attend the conference, and touching base with them about what they would talk about. We also had students involved with the workshops and, you know, teaching people how to dance Bhangra or to do henna tattoos. So that was also great. And I think that really helped us take a break from the academics and, you know, learn some skills that are relating to the region as well. So yeah. I would just like to thank anyone who was involved with it. I mean, I could list names, but that would probably take a long time.
No, I think, and it's true, like, those workshops definitely did break up the academics a bit, and it was a lot of fun, sort of like a very diverse view. So yeah, thank you for coming in, Atiya. It was great talking to you, and best of luck, I guess, with planning the conference next year.
Oh, thank you.
So once again, that was Atiya Jaffer from the Pakistan Students Association discussing her conference last weekend titled Destination South Asia. So we now go on to our campus and local headlines.
The teaching assistants at UBC have voted in favor of a strike, but the union will be returning to the bargaining table on Tuesday. 810 out of the 2,300 eligible TAs participated in Thursday's ballot, with 81% of those voting in favor. The vote grants the union the power to call a strike with 72 hours notice, giving them more leverage for bargaining with the university. Director of UBC Public Affairs, Lucy McNeil, said that the university was disappointed by the vote. She said, quote, our negotiators feel that they were making some real progress with the union at the table. The UBC had agreed to some improvements that the union itself told us were important to them, end quote. The union and UBC came to an agreement on three issues, including capping work at 24 hours a week and creating two new categories for unpaid leave. They also approved specific language in the contract that would allow TAs to participate in collective action without any academic repercussions. Despite this progress, little headway has been made on the question of wages. According to Director McNeil, the union is requesting equal wages to what TAs at the University of Toronto are paid.
And a transgendered woman from Canada who was kicked out of the Miss Universe Canada pageant is urging her supporters to sign an online petition calling for her reinstatement. Miss Universe Canada issued a brief statement last week saying that Jenna Talikova will not compete in the pageant because she didn't meet the requirements to compete, despite having stated otherwise on her entry form. Talikova is asking her Twitter followers to sign the petition, which maintains that she was disqualified from the contest solely because she was born a male. The petition, which already has about 22,000 signatures by Monday afternoon, calls the disqualification discriminatory and unjust. Talikova had said she knew at a very young age that she was a female and started hormone therapy when she was 14, going through gender reassignment surgery at 19.
Those are UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for your provincial and national headlines, as well as your weekend weather forecast with Phil.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder, this month's cover features the experimental punk band Shearing Pinks, three dudes who have been an underground Vancouver staple since 2005 and have over 50 releases, big and small, under their belts. Also featured this month are The Bleeding Hearts, who released their debut EP this month, a review on Wim Wenders' latest film, the 3D dance epic Pina, an update on the Rio's ongoing battle to show movies and serve liquor, not to mention a bunch of excellent show and album reviews, and all of your regular features. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And welcome back to News 101. It's now time for your weekday weather forecast. The weekend was so good, I slipped, man. I couldn't help it.
All good. Thank you, Martin. And good evening, listeners. On the short term, a very well-developed front on the satellite channels off the coast right now. While the brunt of the precip appears to be heading towards Oregon and Northern California, we are going to be affected by the sagging northern tip in the form of overcast skies, lots of precipitation, and slightly elevated wind speeds. Long term isn't looking too bright either, unfortunately, as like hitters waiting up for their turns at bat, several weather systems are lined up in the Pacific Ocean heading in our general direction. Expect consecutive days of rain throughout the week, the worst conditions being Thursday and Friday night. Now, here's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy with a 30% chance of rainfall, low of 8. Tuesday, 50% chance of under 5 millimeters of rainfall, high of 11, low of 8. Wednesday, 40% chance of around 10 millimeters of rain. Winds could get up to 30 kilometers per hour, high of 10, low of 7. Thursday, 60% chance of 10 millimeters of precipitation, high of 9, low of 7. Friday, just under 10 millimeters of rain in the morning and an overcast night, high of 10, low of 5. So, yeah, that's your cheery 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 7 degrees Celsius here on campus. I'm with a lot of people, actually. A lot of cool people in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thank you, Phil, as always. Breaking my heart there with that weather forecast, so it doesn't look too cheery. But to cheer everyone up, we are joined right now by Matt Parson and Sean Craigton, the AMS president and the associate VP academic, who are here to chat with us about the land use area of UBC titled Gage South, which has been proposed to be slated for academic use, which means that any future housing developments must be for students or postdoctoral fellows. For those of you who haven't been following it, this area has been under review since about 2010, when students expressed concern that the neighborhood was to be slated for non-student housing. So yeah, Matt, John, it's great to have you here today.
Oh, great to be here.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, so I guess for those of us or those listeners who may not have followed the Gage South issue as much, can you give a bit of background? Like, I know, Matt, you worked a lot on this as EP academic. So what were the issues and what is this resolution?
I, you know what, I might pass this one off to Sean because Sean's been with the AMS for the past 2 years and he can give a little context as to what happened before my term as the VP academic.
Okay. This process really started under Ben Capolacci, which was Matt's predecessor. This started under Ben Capolacci, which was Matt's predecessor in the VP academic office. When the land use plan amendments came to the university started to change those. It was a comprehensive process that covered all of campus, and one area that we identified as of concern for students was the Gage South area, which was to be slated for non-student housing, which at the time we weren't sure whether it was market housing or not market housing. The university later revised its proposal somewhat to mostly go along the lines of it being faculty-staff housing, but at the time when we started, we weren't sure, and we lobbied quite hard for student housing since 2010. In 2011, Matt stepped in, and I think he can take it away.
Sure. So the process reviewing what to do with the area under review started up, as Sean mentioned, right at the beginning of my term, where it was a full comprehensive look at what should we do with not only the area under review, but its surrounding area, which included McInnes Field and the current Aquatic Center. And much of this past year we've spent on determining, much like a puzzle piece, how to fit all the pieces together, because it's a small space with a lot of programmatical needs in it, and went forward with a proposal to have a new aquatic center being built, which is quite exciting, and also actually a brand new McInnes Field as well, which will be right out front of the new sub. So the campus is going to look quite different around 2014-2015. But there was still this lingering question of what to do with the current bus loop, which is more or less the area in review. And quite recently, just the past week or so, the university has come forward with the decision to make this area and academic, which basically means that they can put anything in there that directly benefits the academic mission of the university. So be that classroom space, student housing, really anything other than you know, market housing or commercial space, which is quite exciting to see, just because throughout this whole process, as Sean said, it being the heart of the campus, the AMS has felt quite strongly that it should remain for students and remain such a, you know, a lively place to ensure that we have a heart of campus.
So given that both of you put so much work into this, was this something that you had expected to see the university shift its stance on? I know that it seemed that there had been a fair bit of conflict and discussion ongoing, evidently, for 2 years. And was there any sort of sign that this was the resolution that would be coming right now, or did it come as a bit of a surprise?
I think what surprised me most was actually the strong outcry from students to keep this area zoned academic. And I think that really caught everyone off guard because, I mean, normally students don't come out in full force around land use designations. But this time around, we saw over 800 people fill out the consultation report, or sorry, the consultation survey, the second round of consultation that was. And for the most part, people filled it out saying that, no, we'd like to see this area remain academic. And if I had to say, you know, what was the one point that started shifting this whole process into more of an academic area, I would say that was the one part. But at the very same time, you have to, you know, really give the university quite a lot of credit to go forward and fully consider the student input and be quite responsive to that and accept that consultation feedback and then fully designate this area as academic.
I have to say I was somewhat surprised by the outcome. I hadn't expected such a positive one, but it was really gratifying to see throughout the entire process just students coming out. This was very much a student voice being heard by the university, which is always really, really gratifying to see.
I know from like the various reports I've seen on this, it seems like there is a little bit of conflict remaining, I guess maybe from other groups and so on, that may not agree with this designation. How do you see this moving forward and maybe resolution of those conflicts, or just the use of, or I guess this this designation for the land use plan, the impact it's going to have on other groups on campus?
I know that there was a group on campus that definitely wanted to see the current aquatic center remain in its current state, or sorry, not remain in its current state, remain in the same original footprint and maybe have a renew and add-on option. And again, to the university's credit, they definitely did sink in quite a lot of resources and time in investigating this as a legitimate option. And you have to trust and rely on the reports that they produced from the quantitative surveyors, which showed that it really would be quite a costly operation with a higher level of risk associated with it, much as any renovation project is.
Of course.
Another area of conflict, I guess, you might be alluding to is the residents, which might have preferred this to be a village center academic zoning, which would have allowed to have non-student housing in this area, just for reasons of maybe expanding this area to include not just students but the broader community as well. And I guess to that, I would argue that just because there's going to be student housing here mainly for graduate students doesn't mean that it's exclusively for students. And I hope that really the idea of this being not only the heart of campus but also the entrance of campus is kept front of mind throughout the whole rest of the planning process, and that residents always throughout that whole process are considered and consulted, and in the ultimate form feel like it's an inviting place.
So is the book closing now, Engage South, for, I guess, especially for your portfolio, Sean? Like, what's next?
Well, it hasn't gone through the Board of Governors for final approval yet, and it will have to go to a public hearing, which, as it stands, is slated for April 25th. After that, the land use designation for Engage South is over, but the planning on the exact, like, the form of the aquatic center, the exact form of the bus loop continues. That's a much less fraught process because we've got the baseline. We've got a baseline here of this as a very student-centric area, thanks to all this ongoing support from students for that. It doesn't close the book on Gay South, but it is writing the final chapter. This is the epilogue where everything kind of comes out in the wash.
Wraps up.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Perfect. Well, yeah, it's very exciting to see, and we look forward to seeing what you guys do with it in the future. Yeah, so thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Great. So once again, that was Matt Parson and Sean Craigton, the AMS president and the associate VP academic, chatting with us about Gage South and the resolution that we've seen come out of that over the last week. So you're listening to CITR News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. It's now time for your provincial and national news.
The bargaining agent for British Columbia's 60 public school boards says teachers should begin preparing their first report cards of the year. The BC Public School Employers Association outlined the position in a message to members late last week, just as students from around the province were wrapping up spring break. The announcement is the latest development in the ongoing contract dispute with the province's 41,000 teachers who have been conducting job action since September and have been refusing to perform many administrative tasks, including writing report cards. Just last week, the BC Teachers Federation announced members will soon vote on whether to withdraw extracurricular activities or stage a full-scale strike in protest of Bill 22, a law that ended a three-day strike and forced them back to work.
A landmark decision has been passed in Ontario to protect sex trade workers. Ontario's Court of Appeal struck down two laws today, calling them unconstitutional. The first is the provision in the Criminal Code that prohibits body houses, which is just a proper name for a whorehouse, and the second makes it illegal to live off the avails of prostitution, which essentially legalizes the act itself. But according to this decision, it is still illegal for prostitutes to communicate with their clients in public places. So what's going to happen with regards to the law text is that the word prostitution will be taken out of the definition of common body houses as it appears in Section 210 of the Criminal Code, which prevents sex trade workers from operating out of fixed indoor locations like brothels or their homes. The court clarified, however, that the brothel and body house rule change wouldn't come into effect for another 12 months so that the Parliament can have a chance to draft replacement legislation that complies with the new rules, if they choose to do so. The changes for living off the avails of prostitution will come into effect after 30 days.
Members of Parliament are back in the House of Commons today after a week off. Today's sitting also marked Thomas Mulcair's unveiling as leader of the official opposition. Mulcair wasted no time in hitting the biggest issue of the day, the presentation of the budget on Thursday. In question period, Mulcair asked a pretty roundabout question, why the government was failing to protect jobs and if the incoming budget would give jobs and hope to young people. In true parliamentary fashion, he was given a roundabout answer. The government has done a good job in managing the economy and continues in its job creation efforts. I know this is really groundbreaking stuff, but it will be Mulcair's first test as a leader. It's not likely that the opposition will be able to influence in any way the budget presented by the Conservatives, but they will be judged on the basis of how much noise and outrage they can drum up. This is a pretty fast turnaround for Mulcair and the NDP. Not 40 hours after winning the leadership, he's sitting in the House of Commons preparing to take on the first budget presented by the majority Conservative government. Many believe that this budget will be our first real glimpse at the unshackled Harper government.
In the wake of Thomas Mulcair's fourth ballot victory to win the leadership of the NDP, a few top staffers are saying no thanks. Several new Democratic officials who had been close to Jack Layton and helped Brian Topp in his failed attempt to gain the leadership of the party are reportedly calling it quits. According to the Globe and Mail, Drew Anderson, director of communications for the NDP, told his staff today that he'll be leaving the party. Anderson is the latest person to join a sort of minor exodus within the NDP ranks. Raymond Gardia was the party's top advisor in Quebec, and he also ran Brian Topp's campaign for leadership, but rumor has it that he's made up his mind to drop the orange banner. Yesterday, Brad Lavigne announced his departure as the NDP's national director. So it would seem that all the talk about the party being split between two camps wasn't a fabrication at all. On the plus side, even those who suffered irreconcilable losses in the campaign seem willing to step aside rather than cause friction that could affect the party's all-important unity.
And now I'll pass it back to Marty for a bit of commentary on the upcoming budget.
As we said earlier, this Thursday is Budget Day, which for most of us is just another petty news item that needs to be ignored. But for those of us who are irreparable masochists, it's time for speculation and good old scrutinizing. The Harper government is looking to brand this budget as an exercise in long-term employment creation, rather than a grim effort to balance the books. We're all expecting significant cuts to government departments and agencies, but the finance minister assures us that the cuts will be moderate. There are essentially five broad themes of the upcoming budget. They are support for innovation and research, overhauling regulation for resource development, investing in training, support for communities and family, and ensuring long-term sustainability of major social programs like old age security. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of political speak, more commonly referred to as gibberish, but let's try to wade through this speculative muck and get some clear picture. One of the more controversial portions of this impending budget is the overhauling regulation for resource development bit. This basically means that the government wants to streamline the environmental review process so they can go ahead with projects like the Enbridge pipeline without being delayed with environmental questions, debates, or generally thinking about the environmental implications of their actions. The long-term sustainability of old-age security is likely to be the Tories' way of testing the waters for changes within these programs. It caused quite a stir when Harper casually mentioned this at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland in January. They might raise the retirement age 2 years to 67. They might tweak some numbers here and there. It's not likely that sweeping changes will be introduced to social programs. Or maybe they will. What do I know? It's more likely a test to see what the government can get away with in messing around with the particulars of old age security. Now, support for families and communities. You got to keep your eyes peeled for funding to Aboriginal communities. In the wake of Attawapiskat, Canadians are gut-wrenchingly aware of the dire situations found in many of our Aboriginal communities. I wonder if there's room in our budget for giving Aboriginal communities decent shelter and maybe even a proper education. And the rest of it, well, there aren't many sane human beings in this country who have the stomach to digest a beefy conservative budget, so we'll just let it rest at that. Believe me, come Thursday, you'll have a hard time avoiding this public pestilence.
Thanks, as always, Marty, for your insight into the political landscape. We're going to take a quick break right now, but please do stay tuned for your international news. You're listening to News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
And welcome back to CITR News 101. It's now time for your international news. We go now to Free Speech Radio News for international headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. In Syria, shelling continued in homes and elsewhere today. The death toll mounts daily, with dozens more people reportedly dead Saturday, as many as 70 Sunday. Turkey recalled its ambassador to Syria, and its embassy in Damascus was shuttered. On Friday, the Department of Homeland Security granted temporary protected status to Syrians in the U.S., protecting them from deportation. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met with former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday and said his plan for peace is, quote, Syria's last chance to avoid a bloody civil war. Medvedev was on his way to a nuclear summit in South Korea, where ahead of the meeting, President Barack Obama met with Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan to coordinate non-lethal support for the Syrian opposition. The second global nuclear security summit officially opened today in Seoul. The main focus of the two-day forum is safeguarding the world's atomic energy supply. Speaking on the sidelines of the summit, President Obama told North Korea's new leadership it must give up its nuclear weapons. From Seoul, Jason Strother has more.
Even though North Korea's nuclear weapons program has been left off the summit's official agenda, it was still clearly on President Obama's mind. During a speech at a Seoul university on Monday, the president addressed the Pyongyang government directly.
But by now it should be clear. Your provocations and pursuit of nuclear weapons have not achieved the security you seek. They have undermined it.
During separate talks, Obama asked Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev and Chinese leader Hu Jintao for help in bringing North Korea back to denuclearization talks. Pyongyang recently announced that next month it will shoot a rocket into space. Analysts say this is a long-range missile test in disguise. Seoul confirmed today the rocket is now on a launch pad. Washington officials say that planned food aid for the North could be called off if the launch goes ahead. Jason Strother, FSRN, Seoul.
Chinese President Hu Jintao is at the summit in Seoul. Later this week, he'll be in India, where hundreds of Tibetan exiles marched today, one man self-immolated. Bismillah Gilani reports.
President Hu Jintao is coming to the annual summit of the BRICS group in New Delhi. The group includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the discussions will focus on cooperation between the five emerging economies. But Tibetan refugees want to draw attention to what they call human rights violations in the Tibetan region of China. Nearly 1,000 demonstrated near the Parliament House today. Tenzin Topden is a member of the Tibetan Youth Congress.
The Chinese policies are the
sole responsible for the self-immolations which had happened in Tibet since 2009. We need your attention. We need your concern to solve the ongoing tragic situation in Tibet under the repressive Chinese rule.
One of the protesters in New Delhi today self-immolated. The police overpowered him, but he suffered serious burns and is in critical condition. In the last year, more than 30 Tibetans in China have set themselves on fire. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade has conceded defeat in the country's presidential race. Alpha Jallo reports.
Senegal's president-elect Macky Sall said his victory in the country's landmark runoff election yesterday marked a new era for the Senegalese people. In a nationwide address last night, Sall hailed the Senegalese people for exercising political maturity. His speech came a few hours after Senegal's outgoing president Abdoulaye Wade called him to concede defeat. The move came just hours into the counting of ballots after peaceful second-round election. President Wade's phone call sent thousands of supporters into the streets of the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Provisional unofficial results from polling centers have pegged Macky Sall leading with almost 65% of the votes. The head of the ECOWAS and African Union Observer Mission, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, praised the outcome of the polls as fair and transparent. President-elect Macky Sall got the backing of 12 opposition candidates in the nation's first contested presidential election. I am Alpha Jallo in Dakar, Senegal.
Georgia's breakaway region, South Ossetia, held elections Sunday, the third time since November. Previously, an opposition figure won the majority, but that decision was annulled in a controversial move that sparked widespread protest. FSRN's MJ Raquelme reports.
In yesterday's elections, no candidate got an outright majority, so a runoff will be held in 2 weeks. The contenders will be former KGB chief Leonid Tibilov and human rights ombudsman David Zanakoyev. Tibilov, who got a 42% of the ballot, campaigned on an anti-corruption platform. Zanakoyev, the ombudsman, is a relative newcomer and is 35 years old. He polled nearly 25%. Both candidates are firmly pro-Moscow and reject reapproachment with the Republic of Georgia, which fought a brief war with Russia in 2008 after trying to regain the territory. Yet in this picture, there is someone missing, Ala Gioeva, who won last November's poll before the result was annulled by the Supreme Court in a decision that sparked great unrest. She was hospitalized for weeks, allegedly against her will, until Saturday when she was released. MJ Riquelme, FSRN, Tbilisi, Georgia.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
The Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments today on the constitutionality of the President's Affordable Care Act. Some camped out all weekend long for a spot in the courtroom for this politically volatile case. But today's arguments avoided the more ideological aspects and focused instead on whether the health care reform bill can even be challenged before it fully goes into effect in 2014. FSRN's Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and files this report.
It's been more than 2 years since Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, and President Obama signed it into law. Now, the Supreme Court is weighing the constitutionality of the landmark health care reform over 3 days of oral arguments this week. Hundreds of demonstrators, both for and against the Affordable Care Act, gathered on the steps of the Supreme Court Monday morning to have their say.
We love Obamacare! We love Obamacare! We love Obamacare!
Doctors in white lab coats marched next to anti-abortion activists with tape over their mouths, while Tea Party groups waved the iconic Don't Tread on Me flag. Marlis Cox, who lost her insurance when her husband left her, came from Florida to share what health care reform means to her.
During the 11 years since my divorce, my premiums went from $300 to $1,100 a month with Blue Cross Blue Shield. I could not afford the medication for the hepatitis, which cost $40,000 a year, because insurance only covered 60% of that. I had alimony, but because of my chronic illness, I had few employment opportunities. Like so many, I was stuck between making too much to qualify for help, but not making enough to afford the high premiums that insurance companies charged me because of my pre-existing condition. The Affordable Care Act was a light at the end of the tunnel, and it came just in the nick of time for me.
Cox, who was also diagnosed with breast cancer, directed some of her remarks at the Tea Party protesters and some at the Supreme Court justices inside.
To those against reform, I ask, what happens to me and others in similar situations as mine now if this law is found to be invalid? I want to help this court to understand the stakes in the decision it is weighing today. After all, it is only right. People must not die because of greed.
Inside the courtroom was a completely different scene. Hundreds of people watched silently as the justice weighed several technical tax and jurisdiction arguments, seeking to determine whether the court can rule on the challenges to the Affordable Care Act before the buy insurance or pay a penalty rule goes into effect, and someone refuses to pay. The debate centered on the Anti-Injunction Act, which Congress passed in 1867 to make sure people paid their taxes before challenging the legality of the taxes, ensuring the government had enough revenue to function. But does the penalty for not buying health insurance count as a tax? The court appointed D.C. Attorney Robert Long to argue it's close enough.
Our initial submission is you don't have to determine that this is a tax in order to find that the Anti-Injunction Act applies, because Congress very specifically said that it shall be assessed and collected in the same manner as a tax, even if it's a tax penalty and not a tax.
Some justices challenged Long's assertion, saying the purpose of the penalty isn't to raise revenue, but to incentivize health care, even though the Congressional Budget Office predicts the penalty will raise more than $100 billion over 10 years. Gregory Katsas, who argued Monday on behalf of the states challenging the law, also held that the penalty isn't a tax and urged the court to go ahead and rule on the merits of the Affordable Care Act.
The President of the United States was very clear that this insurance mandate is not a tax. There's a requirement to buy health insurance. That's what we're challenging. It's backed up by a penalty. Penalty is not a tax.
Katsas said the penalty is entirely separate from what he sees as the main constitutional issue of the Affordable Care Act, the mandate for all Americans to buy health insurance. But Chief Justice Roberts disagreed, saying the two pieces can't be separated.
It's a command. Mandate is a command. Now, right. If there's nothing behind the command, sort of, well, what happens if you don't follow the mandate? And the answer is nothing. It seems very artificial to separate the punishment from the crime. Pay, you know, buy insurance or else what? Or else nothing.
If the court rules that the Anti-Injunction Act applies, the rest of the legal questions about the Affordable Care Act have to be put on hold until at least 2015, when the controversial minimum coverage mandate takes effect. But the court will still hear arguments on the constitutionality of that mandate on Tuesday. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The U.S. This week, Georgia lawmakers are expected to take action on a controversial anti-immigrant measure called SB 458. The bill would ban undocumented students from attending public college and universities and would criminalize the acceptance of foreign passports as valid forms of identification. The Georgia bill is part of a broader effort to criminalize immigrant communities that includes measures in Alabama, Arizona, South Carolina, and other states. Another law from Georgia, HB 87, was passed last year and currently faces legal challenges in a federal appeals court. For more, we're joined by Azadeh Shashahani, National Security and Immigrants Rights Project Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia. Azadeh Shashahani, let's begin with where this measure is now. Where is it in the legislative process, and what do you expect for this week?
Yes, thank you, Dorian. We are now on the last week of the legislative session, and so this particular measure, Senate Bill 458, has already passed the Senate. And last week, it passed out of a committee in the House. So right now, it might be heading to the House floor later this week.
Okay. And also to make it clear, listeners may be familiar with the law passed in Georgia last year. That's the HB 87, and that's currently under appeal in federal appeals court, along with the Alabama law.
Right. House Bill 87 was the anti-immigrant law that passed last year. And as you mentioned, two provisions of the law have been blocked as a lawsuit brought by the ACLU and other organizations, particularly the Show Me Your Papers provision and another provision that would have criminalized acts of giving a ride to an undocumented person or housing an undocumented person. And so this bill will amend House Bill 87 in some ways.
And let's get into some of those changes or some of those ways it would change SB 458, the measure that is under consideration this week by lawmakers. Two areas there that people have expressed concern about. One is on identification and one is on the effect on education and access to education. Let's look at identification first. How would this measure affect what kind of identification is acceptable and how would that affect people?
Right. So what this bill does, Senate Bill 458, is that it removes foreign passports from the listing of secure and verifiable documents. And the impact of that would be that undocumented immigrants in Georgia would, in effect, have no way to prove their identity. Because right now, a foreign passport in Georgia is one of the only ways that an undocumented immigrant can, for example, get access to water or sewage services, can gain access to a building, a governmental building, can prove their identity when they want to enroll their child at an elementary school, or for purposes of getting married, getting a marriage certificate. And we know that the right to marry is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution.
So if this measure were to go forward and it would criminalize the acceptance of many foreign passports, what options would be available to people for identification purposes?
Well, practically speaking, there would not be any options. And, you know, this is in line with the intent of some legislators in Georgia to make life so difficult for undocumented immigrants that they would have to leave this state.
Another part of the measure under consideration is on education. It would ban all undocumented students from public colleges and universities. Now, how could this affect people in Georgia?
As of this moment, undocumented students in Georgia are prohibited from gaining access to the most selective public colleges and universities, regardless of their academic qualifications, and even though they're paying out-of-state tuition. But some Georgia lawmakers were not even happy with this partial ban, and they wanted to go ahead and deny all access to public higher education to undocumented students. And so this is what the ban would do as envisioned in SB 458.
Azadeh Shashahani is National Security and Immigrants Rights Project Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia. She spoke to us about Georgia's immigration measure SB 458 under consideration this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today, rallies are taking place in cities across the U.S. to mark 1 month since the shooting of Trayvon Martin, the unarmed teenager killed in Sanford, Florida. On Saturday, about 1,000 people marched through Tampa's Al Lopez Park to support justice in the case. The crowd chanted, "We are Trayvon," and "No justice, no peace." Many held signs and wore hooded sweatshirts similar to what Martin was wearing when he was shot. The alleged shooter, George Zimmerman, was not charged because he claimed self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground gun law. Sean Canan from WMNF Community Radio asked rally participants whether they think Florida's gun laws need to be changed.
Okay, yeah, I think they could be changed. What I do to change them is stop or regulate the people that use firearms, you know, for everybody to be safe. That's what all I do.
Absolutely. I think they need to have more statue around them to clearly define what Stand Your Ground is, what that means, and when you approach someone with deadly force, what your expectation is and what your motive is.
Florida's gun laws, I mean, they're okay, but sometimes you get some people that go gung-ho as far as getting, they want to get licensed and get the permits to carry the gun and everything. Some people may get a little gung-ho about it.
I feel like a person that's able-bodied to protect themselves should not have the advantages of the gun law to to murder or harm or hurt another individual because they feel threatened or they just felt like they have the authority by possessing a weapon that they can use it.
Attorney General Pam Bondi and Governor Rick Scott, we have to come to the table. The time is now. The momentum is now. Trayvon Martin's incident is not an isolated incident. It's happening across the nation where many black children and black men, children, period, are being killed at the hands of people standing their grounds.
So the Stand Your Ground law says that you have the right to protect yourself any place you have a right to lawfully be, essentially, right? And I personally don't feel like chasing somebody down entitles you to be in a right. You may rightfully have a right to be there, but at the same time, you've exceeded that. You know, so I don't think the gun law is necessarily the problem. It might not be a good law, but the problem is how we're interpreting it and how we're enforcing it.
I definitely think that something needs to change, but I'm still kind of up in the air about how all of this came into play. What was the goal? What was it that we were trying to prevent? Who was it that we were trying to protect? So I think all of these things need to be answered before anything could be changed, but definitely now's the time.
Well, what I would do to improve and make sure that guns don't get in everybody's hands. It needs to stick with law enforcement officers and, you know, people like that. It shouldn't be readily available for anybody on the street to get a gun.
I think there will be a longer waiting period for people when they're applying to get the weapons, a much longer background check, and to the individuals who are applying for the guns to make sure, you know, that they're not felons and the guns aren't falling into the wrong hands. Visual antis, you know, what have you. I think Florida needs to make stricter gun laws all around.
I think we do need to make some adjustments in the gun laws. I am a proponent of safe gun ownership for citizens. The problem isn't really the citizens who legally own guns. The problem is with the amount of illegal guns that are out on the streets today. Finding a way to clean those up, keeping the guns out of the hands of young people. I mean, let's be honest here, if you're under 21, just like there's certain things you can't do legally, you shouldn't be allowed to own a gun. But safe gun ownership is the key. Now, the Stand Your Ground law, it's not going to hold up in this case. He wasn't confronted. He wasn't attacked. There wasn't a confrontation. You can tell that from the 911 cases.
Those were the voices of Florida residents Jay Redd of Fort Pierce, Miranda Hill of Tampa, Ernest Hunter of Odessa, Nashawn Shannon of St. Petersburg, Michelle Williams of Tampa, Will Munnerlin of Clearwater, and Tampa residents Fire White, Deborah Broxton, Tammy Williams, and Ed Norain. They spoke at what was called a Million Hoodies March in Tampa on Saturday.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
But not for long. That is our program for today, March 26, 2012. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast, listen to past shows, and listen to our interviews on our website, citr.ca. For more independent news, join us right here Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced with love by Iqbal Ahmed and CJ Mahajan. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening.
And stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 o'clock right here on CITR 101.9 FM.